from the leaf-covered studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another Fall Fever Hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. The leaves are falling all around us. How are you planning to deal with them? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll reveal how to handle those leaves to your garden's benefit and protect pollinators. Plus, Elliot Coleman explains that everything your garden needs in the future is right there in the present. And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and amiably adroit assertions. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up right after the news.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John on the blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Second antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY, for 30 years.
From the ant-infested studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another informative hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we present a very interesting article about surprisingly beneficial ants that originally appeared back in the February issue of National Geographic magazine, written by Eric Alt and a German wildlife photographer whose name is spelled A-R-N-D-T, but is pronounced ant. Ant discovered his first enormous ant mound almost 50 years ago as a child exploring the forest with his father near their home in Germany. They were bird watching and came around a bend in a densely wooded area where they found a 5-foot-tall mound covered with a thick layer of spruce needles and throngs of tiny red ants. Ant wanted to investigate more closely, but a peculiar smell held him back. The air felt thick and pungent, stinging his nostrils like vinegar. All my life, he says, I've remembered that smell. It turns out that the mound makers were red wood ants, scientifically classified as a group within the genus Formica, not to be confused with the substance used to make kitchen countertops. In recent decades, these nests have been disappearing as the forests have fallen victim to logging, urbanization, and wildfires. This has led several countries, including Germany, to designate the ants as a species protected by law. The massive nests consist of two parts, one above ground and one below. Each mound can support upwards of 16 million insects, the largest above-ground nests of any ant species in the world. The ants generate formic acid in a gland at the rear of their abdomen. As they build a nest, the insects gather a tree resin that has been shown to possess antimicrobial properties, and spray it with their acid, which has its own antimicrobial properties. The result is a potent agent that the ants place throughout the structure to fight against bacterial and fungal pathogens. Formic acid also powers the species' pest control role. The fluid is weaponized to take down other insects, like wood-boring beetles, one of the most destructive vermin in spruce forests. The ants bite the beetles and then spray formic acid into the wounds, killing beetles that would otherwise have weakened and destroyed those trees. Using camera traps, Ant also captured larger animals lining up to get sprayed voluntarily. A rare image shows the Eurasian jay landing on top of a mound and calmly flattening out its tail to allow the ants to crawl up and attack. While the birds appear unharmed, the toxin is powerful enough to disperse or kill parasites such as lice and mites that the birds carry. This behavior helps many species of birds stay healthy. Ant's project highlights the strange and amazing ways these often overlooked creatures are influencing the world around them. While he did his best to avoid disrupting the protected species, the ants at times had other ideas, and they'd hitch a ride back with him. "I'll be out at dinner, and they show up and walk all over my pants," he says, laughing at the memory. "But I always try and bring everybody back to the nest. The forest needs their collective power."
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, we will advise you on how to collect some of your fall leaves for compost making and mulching your summer garden, while leaving others behind to protect overwintering good insects. You won't want to miss it. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. Number to call, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Dan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, great. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, Dan. Where is here for you?
Sparta, Missouri, Southwest Missouri, in the Ozarks.
You know, there are so many states that have a Sparta in their name.
Yes.
There's New York, there's New Jersey. Now, you're the first one I've heard from down Missouri way, but would be an interesting historical documentary. But that's not what we're here for. What can we do you for today? Okay.
Well, I was trying to find out information more about how to try to recycle school cafeteria waste.
Oh, okay. So in industrial settings, which is what we're talking about, it's really no different than a restaurant, there are two types of waste, pre and post. Now, the pre is all the vegetable peelings, the outer leaves, the shucking of the corn stalks, before any cooking is done. And that can be recycled in a good size outdoor compost pile that has enough shredded leaves. The pre involves all the kitchen preparatory waste, you know, the broccoli stalks, the bad parts of the tomatoes, and that part has not been cooked. So you can treat that the same as you can kitchen waste in an outdoor bin that contains enough of dry brown plant material. Or you can feed it into a conventional worm bin.
Yeah, that's what I had in mind. Worms, oh. Yes. Definitely. Worms is my objective.
Oh, yeah. And
to use it to grow worms.
Well, you know, if you do the bin correctly, I like the towers where you...
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So, and all they need is some shredded newspaper on top, and they produce a perfect fertilizer. Yep. So the waste that comes out of the kitchen can be composted anyway, in any manner.
Yes.
But once it is cooked and perhaps subject to oil and salt and things like that, the post-cafeteria waste is a tricky business, but it can be done, and it is being done. There is this crazy student organization. I don't know how long they've been around. The last time I checked their website, the information was from this year. But it's the AS Department, and you're going to love this, of Public Worms.
Yes, huh.
And they're at the University of Santa Barbara, and they service, basically, they have a totally integrated system where they take all their waste and feed huge community gardens that are tended to and then used by the students. I did a little digging, and it turns out that this is, you know, part of your student fees. So it's totally funded by students, but through the college. And they have, I want to warn people, if you go to their website, the AS Department of Public Worms, which is hilarious. I'm not happy with some of their backyard compost information. They advocate 50% greens and 50% browns. And to me, it's got to be at least 75% leaves. Because leaves are what become the compost. The nitrogen-rich green material feeds those living microbes all over the leaves and actually transforms them into compost, you know, 5-10 times faster than would happen in nature. And they also say that good brown amendments include sawdust, newspaper, and straw. Now, in a place without deciduous trees, and you make sure you get straw and not hay, that's perfectly acceptable for at least some of the browns. But you don't want to put wood, like sawdust, into a compost pile. And you don't want to use newspaper, because even if it's made with soy inks and there's no color, no slick, it's been bleached and it has no nutrition to contribute.
So,
you know, that's the line. These items like the brown food trays and stuff like that that say compostable, yes.
Yeah.
If you put them in a pile, they will lose their original look, but they don't add anything. And I want my compost pile to produce the highest quality compost. So for me, it's almost all shredded leaves, coffee grounds, which are great, high in nitrogen. I guess like you, I don't put any kitchen scraps in my outdoor bins. I give them to my worms and harvest their castings.
Yeah, worms.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I had in mind, absolutely.
So to take, you know, now we're talking garbage. Now we're talking stuff
so,
off.
So with the processed school food that the kids dump into the waste, was it, is that compostable? Would that be good warm food?
Well, here's the deal. When you've got this mixed kitchen waste that could include other elements, yeah. And of course, you know, that you have to sort out the cups and the plastic forks and soda cans and stuff like that. But yeah. Then when you're left with what my grandmother used to call slop, there are very specialized machines that utilize worms that know exactly what to do in terms of moving the material around, the correct temperature, always checking for moisture content. And out of that, you know, because the worms are there, you get the same quality compost that you would in our home worm bins. But it's very specialized machinery, and it has to be done on a large scale. And what I like about what these kids are doing is they collect it, they sort it, they put it in the proper area, and then they turn the piles, they harvest the piles at planting time, they plant huge community gardens, and then that goes into the kids' cafeteria food. I mean, we loved closed circles in the organic movement.
Yeah, you bet.
But
that was really good.
You would have to look into industrial food waste composting.
I'll do that. Well, thanks a lot. I didn't realize that the processed food would be that much different.
Oh, yeah. Raw material, piece of cake. Cooked material, you enter problems. But they figured out how to solve these problems on a massive scale.
I see. Well, that sounds a lot. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. Now I need to get the kids to be able to separate the trash from their compostable material. That's what's hard to do.
There's a lot of information at their website, the Department of Public Worms, and you know, it will be some community organizing as well. But I think you'd be surprised. I mean, kids in college are supposed to be energetic and idealistic, and I think you'll find a lot of people who want to even have this on their resumes.
Right. Okay. I'll sure look into that.
Well, I wish you great luck, sir, and thank you for getting involved in helping out with this waste.
Good compost just can't be beat. It's the only way to go, that's for sure.
You got it, man. All right. Well, good luck to you. Call us back if you have any problems. And
I'll do that.
Bye-bye for now.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that the time has passed for you to do anything to your cool season lawn of bluegrass, fescue, and or rye. No feeding, no aerating, no power raking, and no anything else. Right now, just cut it at the normal correct height of 3 to 3.5 inches and leave the mulched clippings on the lawn to fertilize it. But don't go dreaming of warm days to come just yet, because we'll be right back to talk with one of the acknowledged masters of self-sufficient growing and take more of your self-sufficient phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host. Coming up later in the show, we will talk about how to collect fall leaves, whether you should collect them, is there a middle ground? And this is timely and important, cats and kittens, so I want you to listen. But right now, I am promoting a very special guest. This is a real treat for me. Elliot Coleman is one of the fathers. You know, he would be on Mount Rushmore of organic advocates. I've watched Elliot for many, many years, more years than either he or I probably care to admit. He has come out with a new book that really explains a lot about how far we've come in the last 30, 40, 50 years. It is The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method, and it is brand spanking new from Chelsea Green Publishing. Elliot, it's so wonderful to have you back on the show.
Well, Mike, it's been a long time since we talked, but I'm glad to be back on your show.
I'm glad that you're still out there inspiring other gardeners.
Yeah, I'm now 86 years old, so I'm pretty proud that I'm still vertical and more or less useful.
Yeah, you will never be non-useful. You'll be useful even long after you start taking your dirt nap.
Okay.
I should mention that in the past, Elliot has produced some books that are real Bibles for organic growers. The Four Season, what's the exact name of that one?
Four Season Harvest was the one for home gardeners. If there are commercial growers who also want to grow in the winter in unheated greenhouses, there's a book for them too.
And I should mention that while I talk about it and I have a little home garden, you walk. I mean, you walk your talk. And for many, many years, you did a lot of hard labor on these farms to magical success. Elliot means what he says, kids, when he grew food for 12 months of the year on the chilly coast of Maine. You know, if he can do it there, you sure can try and do it in a normal climate.
Yes, and the best thing about that was it wasn't focused on heated greenhouses. It was on unheated greenhouses with a layer of fabric above the crops inside the greenhouse, so you had a double covered area.
And right.
Basically, the reason it worked was each layer of covering moved the zone you live in further to the south, and with two layers of covering, we were able to turn Maine into Georgia.
Oh, wow. I got to come out for some peaches.
Yeah.
Now, this book really is a history of what we've been doing since the 70s and 80s and how things have changed. Back in the beginning, especially during the time I was editor of Organic Gardening, we did a lot, and you cover this well in your book, about what inputs you could put into your garden and still be considered organic.
Yes, but that's because, and I think the simple reason for that is that magazines are supported far more by their advertising income than by their subscriptions. And so any magazine that wants to stay in business is going to need to take advertising. And the people most likely to advertise on a gardening magazine are companies selling garden products.
Yep. Now, I will intersperse here that that was not my problem. I didn't have to deal with that. Organic gardening had always been subscriber-supported, much like public radio. And when we got really popular, the people who bought ads were in Detroit. You know, we were big on truck ads and things like that. And they were very nice, but this is one case where the readers really supported the magazine, and that's a treasured thought of mine.
Oh, no, and that was the nice thing about it. The road deals were so good at presenting organic gardening to convince people that anybody could do it, and they showed in that magazine how easy it was to be successful.
Yeah, and these people, I mean, we had to turn around a lot of battleships, right? These people were used to going in and saying, I got a weed problem. Well, you need Roundup. Here you go. We got it right here on every shelf in the store. And if you go in with even a lawn program that obviously overfeeds and overchemicalizes a lawn, they would sell you that hard because that meant you were going to have problems and you'd have to be coming back and buying more and more. And I was astounded even early on, just as an amateur growing on my own, how needless that stuff was, and more importantly, how destructive it could be. But people were used to buying things. I have a problem. What will you sell me?
Right. Well, also, because the government was 100% behind the chemical invasion of gardening, they were telling everybody that was the way to go.
Right. Weren't the early extension services supported by fertilizer companies?
I'm not surprised. I do have one fascinating pamphlet on my shelf from, I think this is the 40s,
right,
when the chemical companies were having to admit that their products worked best when there was a lot of organic matter in the soil. And I think that's the only time they ever said anything positive about anything except chemicals.
Yeah, and since then they've done their best to reverse that.
Yes, yes.
Now, you and I, we had not met. Nobody knew who I was when I came out of the woodwork. But I had been growing a fabulous organic garden for 10 years before I took over the magazine, and it never occurred to me to buy stuff.
Yeah, but if I went in back then to my local seed and feed store, even so much as mentioned the word organic, the guy would brighten up and suddenly try and sell me soybean meal or dried blood or all of those things, because he was aware that there were an alternate group of gardeners who thought those products were better. And so depending on where you were, if the USDA wasn't in charge, the storekeepers in the garden world were anxious to sell you all those organic inputs.
I think it actually brought more people into the hobby or into the business. It was just a natural transition. They got this bag instead of that bag, and this bag wasn't going to cause any harm.
Yes. They were all benign as far as the environment was concerned, although I suspect too much dried blood could have given you a excessive nitrogen runoff somewhere. But, yeah, they were more in tune with the ecology concept than with the we're going to use everything we can to get plants to grow concept.
One of the things I have been especially pleased with in the movement over the years is the transition to, quote, no spray. You know, we're not using anything that we have to buy. Your whole book is a testimony to how you don't have to buy anything. You just have to manage the stuff that's on your property correctly.
That's a good way to put it. The person who was making that argument years ago, surprisingly enough, was Edward Faulkner. The thing is, if you go on the web to any of these no-till sites, you will find they're always citing Edward Faulkner as the father of no-till. They should be embarrassed they didn't read past the cover page of his first book, Plowman's Folly. Because, yeah, he thought plowing was a bad idea, plowing with a turn plow, because it buried all the surface organic matter in the bottom of the furrow. But he was 100% in favor of tillage, as long as it was tillage that was mixing organic matter into the top 4 inches of the soil.
I know that a lot of people who listen to my show have been doing this for a decade or more. Because one of the questions that's been popping up frequently is, my raised beds seem a little bit heavy. And I'd go, well, how long ago did you build these beds? And they go, 15, 20 years ago. And I go, well, even though in the past we told you to throw away your rototiller and everything like that, it might be time to resuscitate that bed, loosen up the soil. I'm a huge fan of perlite. That's the only thing I bring onto my property.
Oh, yeah, it's a good product, yes.
And it lightens the soil. To have to do that like once every 15 years is not a burden. And then I also really stress that once they're done their tilling, they've done their soil amendment, leveled everything out, I urge them to soak the soil to where it can't hold any more moisture, and then wait 10 days for any buried weed seeds to come to the surface, and yep, then just slice their little heads off with a diamond hoe, and you won't have weed problems the rest of the year. That's the stale seedbed, right?
That stale seedbed is the perfect name for that technique, yes.
So what do you want people to do? Is it as simple, because simple ideas tend to be the best, to really start looking around their property for all these inputs that they may be neglecting or putting out at the curb, or even worse, misusing? You know, people who think a compost pile can be all garbage, and you and I know it can't. You need browns and you need greens, and it's great if you can turn it. But it's no more work for the homeowner or the small-scale gardener. It's just a different type of work.
Yes, yes, absolutely. During the writing of this present book, I ran into a study that was done back in 1950 in New Jersey on all of their very sandy soils. And the author of the study's name for the technique was land resting.
Right.
And land resting, as he defined it, was sowing the soil to a pasture mix. And he found out that doing that, even if you're a commercial grower for 1 year out of every three, you improved your general yields amazingly. And that's because there is nothing as good as a year in sod to put fertility, old-time fertility, back into the soil.
Now, wasn't this even biblical, as in on the seventh day you will rest, right?
Yeah, interesting, yeah. Well, the whole concept of land resting has been proven by farmers in England and Europe for many years, and they have found that the best way to have an almost perennial farm is to put the land into pasture mix, graze it with grazing animals, and then after 4 years of that, till it up shallowly with a rototiller, and then grow 4 years of alternating grains and fodder crops. And what you were doing, the years in pasture being grazed, and that was being fertilized on a daily basis by the droppings from the livestock, but that allowed the soil to build up organic matter because of the roots, the deep roots of all the pasture crops. And then after 4 years of that, you got 4 years without having to add any fertilizer because you were, during the 4 years in pasture, you were building up fertility, and then you could spend 4 years exploiting that fertility, and at the end of the second 4 years, you put it back into grass pasture again. This was known as ley farming, L-E-Y, and it was probably the most successful back in the 40s system for perpetual fertility.
And to make this applicable to home gardeners, think of the number of raised beds that you have. And depending on that number, give one or two of them at least a year's rest.
You got it.
To recover. Yep. But meanwhile, you know, you just got to keep track. And then at the end of that year, you move on to the next set of beds and you take your time to get the job completely done. But when it's done, you're in the cycle. You know, this is part of your garden life now.
Yes, yes, absolutely. For a lot of people, maybe they only have a small yard and only a few raised beds. That isn't going to be easy to grow your fertility in the soil you're growing vegetables in. But it turns out that you can grow green manures during the times of the year the garden is not growing vegetables.
In the winter, yeah.
In the winter or in the between winter and spring or between summer and fall, there's lots of ways to grow homegrown fertility right in the same land that you're growing your vegetables on.
But I would also suggest that if you are making really high quality compost that you can get by with just a crop rotation, you know.
Yes, in fact, I explain in the book that we don't, on our market garden, make very much compost anymore because we now, rather than harvesting a lot of crops and taking them to a place where you're processing them for market, we now do all that processing right in the field. So let's say we're harvesting leeks.
Right.
We'll go out there and we'll pull the leeks, peel off any outer leaves that don't look beautiful, cut off the tops, cut the roots off, and then leave all that trash right in the leek bed, because when it's over, we then go through there with the rototiller, till all of that in shallowly, and then put that land into a green manure. And I already own the leek trimmings, so the idea that I was going to compost them, I'm taking them away from the garden. If I leave them right in the garden and till them in, and then add more with the green manure, I have a pretty good system going.
Well, listen, I'm going to get in trouble if I go on much longer with you. But I want to mention we've been talking to Elliot Coleman, who is semi-retired from his four-season farm. He has a great new book out from Chelsea Green. It's called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. And over the years, my gardens have gotten better and better just by practicing simple things. You know, this used to be trash in your mind. Well, not if you use it correctly.
You got it. And, you know, you were fortunate that you were working at Rodale. I don't think in today's world the Rodale father and son get as much credit as they should for having created almost the passion for organic in the U.S.
Absolutely. Without J.I., we never would have known about Sir Albert Howard, biodynamics. You know, J.I. was a super pioneer.
He definitely was, and he took a lot of abuse from the chemical people for it, but he was right on target.
Yeah, it was a magical place. But I see, after a lapse, I see more and more people getting interested in self-sufficiency. And, you know, I don't have a huge property, and I can make it self-sufficient. Almost anybody can. You just have to roll the dice a slightly different way. And more importantly, go to your local garden center if you're not a good seed starter and buy the plants. But otherwise, you got everything you need at home already to grow them. But Elliot, once again, it has been a distinct pleasure. I wish you success with the book. I urge everybody out there to get it. And if you ever have something you want to say, you got my number now.
Okay. After many years of sort of not communicating, it's great to be chatting with you again, Mike. And I wish you all the best with your show and your other project.
And the same to you, and enjoy your semi-retirement. You have earned it. All right.
Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Good to talk to you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of you in normal climate zones that the time for planting is over. And yes, that specifically includes cool season crops, as we now receive less than the 10 hours of daylight required to grow plants big enough to survive the winter. But don't go planning that move to San Diego just yet, because we'll be right back with the rules for proper leaf collection and more of your proper phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden in the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will advise you on how to collect some of your fall leaves for compost making and mulching your summer garden while leaving others behind to protect overwintering good insects. You won't want to miss it, and you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Glad to be on again.
It is Bill Wong from Yardley, is it not?
That is correct, with yet another question.
And you always have interesting ones. So what do you got for us today?
Okay, well, this time it's about seeds. You know, when should you buy them? How long will they keep? And things like that. Because, you know, I've also been trying to harvest seeds from things like cucumber, melon, and watermelon. I've been doing pretty good with those. And my scarlet runner beans are, you know, trivial. But there are a lot of other things that are more challenging, like tomatoes. And, you know, a lot of times I'm going out to buy new seeds or things like onions and potatoes where, you know, going with starts or something like that makes a difference. But one of the interesting things, I was looking at the seed packets.
Right.
And they tell you how much percent germination. And
right.
Some of these are really low, like 50% or more. So, you know, half the seeds won't germinate.
Now, are you asking about saving seed or buying seed?
This is more about buying seeds, you know, and how long they'll last. So I still have some seeds from this year that I hadn't gotten around to planting. I, you know, used half of them. Are they going to be good next year? How do I store them? You know, how long will they last? And again, it's probably different from seed to seed.
It is. You mentioned onion seed, which is notoriously short-lasting. You really can't save onion seed past its original planting designated time. But things like scarlet runner beans and other beans for storage, as long as they're bone dry, they need to rattle in the pod. Then what you do is you put them in a jar with a lot of those desiccating pouches that come with running shoes and vitamins, and put them in the coolest, driest place in the house. Temperature and humidity not to exceed 100 degrees. If you want to reuse your seeds, you wait until about a week or two before you would normally start your starts. You wrap them up in moist paper towels, not soaking wet, not dry. Put them in like a Ziploc or something, but don't lock it. Just fold it over gently. Check them in 10 days, and that's your germination rate, man.
Okay.
You know, you put in 10 seeds, you got 8. Those seeds are pretty viable. Now, what I will say is right around now is when I prowl garden centers and hardware stores, you know, seeds that are marked for 2025 that I know last a couple of years, you know, they're on sale for like 80, 90% off. They want to get rid of them. So if I find some seeds that I really like, I buy a bunch of them, but the investment was almost nothing. And if you go online, you will find great lists of how long stored seeds stay viable. Just read the literature first and make sure you're not buying stuff that's not going to germinate after a year or two.
Yeah. Okay. I'll do some more hunting then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is the prime time of year.
Now, there was one other aspect to this. Things like potatoes and onion starts, I found that I really just need to order those, say, in the fall, because they actually deliver them in the spring.
Yeah.
But by the time spring rolls around, if you try to order then, they're usually out of stock.
Right. Well, pay attention, man. You know, they have harvested their crops. Again, they don't want to store them. They'd rather get them in your hands, mm-hmm. where, again, you would store them in a cool, dry place, and then they're ready for planting.
Okay, well, there are lots of different things from seeds and everything else, so I'll have to keep it on my calendar as to when various things need to happen.
A garden calendar can be the most valuable tool a gardener can have. Very Jeffersonian. One of these days, maybe I'll start one.
I'm ahead of you. I have it all on a spreadsheet. So.
Oh, of course you do. All right, Bill. Nice talking with you again.
Likewise. Thanks for all the info.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week, how to handle leaf litter. I always go on a tear this time of year, urging gardeners everywhere to shred and collect every fall leaf possible for raised bed mulching and compost making. Shredded fall leaves, after all, are the backbone of a proper organic garden, a perfect weed-suppressing mulch, and the essential dry brown ingredient in a compost pile. What about paper instead of leaves? If handled correctly, shredded office paper, newsprint, and those nifty compostable takeout food containers will break down in the compost pile. But to what avail? Fall leaves are full of plant nutrition and essential micronutrients, as well as billions of beneficial microbes teeming with microscopic life that put life back into worn-out soils. But paper products have none of these attributes. They are sterile, nutrient-free, and may contain bleach and heavy metals. Paper will technically compost, as in eventually degrade, but it will not become compost. However, over the past few years, various societies and universities have begun questioning the removal of, quote, leaf litter. Some delightful butterflies and important pollinators overwinter in leaf litter, they note. And collecting and shredding those fall leaves could lead to a decline in their numbers or help explain an already obvious decline in species like lightning bugs. I feel compelled to add that some nasty pest insects also spend the winter the same way, like dangerous and aggressive yellow jackets. As the summertime hive begins to die, impregnated females take flight, overwinter in leaf litter, and emerge in the spring. They find an old mouse hole or vole hole, fly into it, and begin to give birth to workers who will enlarge that hole and build a huge, complex nest inside. A nest that will contain thousands of mad stingers by mid-August. On the other hand, one of our most amazing insects, the hummingbird clearwing moth, goes through part of its life cycle nestled inside a thin cocoon under leaf litter. It's a day-flying moth that looks and acts exactly like a tiny hummingbird. And it's an excellent pollinator. It is always a delight to see one of these false hummers in the garden, buzzing away in one of nature's greatest disguises. So what are we to do? Shred our leaves to make compost that will help balance the ill effects of chemical farming and gardening that deplete our soil, or leave the leaves alone and let nature take her course. Thankfully, I don't suffer this moral dilemma. I have a small forest just across the street and a larger one behind and around my home, where leaves are left to nature. We do, however, suck up the leaves that fall on our walkways and garden and what passes for a lawn in the backyard using a leaf blower with a vacuum setting and collection bag, which shreds them into smaller pieces as they are collected. Then we empty the bags into bins where they are mixed with spent coffee grounds and weeds that have not yet gone to seed, eventually creating better garden soil than anything you can buy. Kitchen waste, that goes into my multi-level worm bin to avoid attracting vermin to the outdoor compost. Those with a classic lawn should use a dedicated mulching mower to chop up and return those nutrients to the lawn, providing all of the food that your grass is going to require. Back to the main event. Should you leave your leaves alone or work with them to horticultural benefit? The answer depends a good deal on your individual situation. Location. The pest and beneficial insects that spend the winter in leaf litter vary across the country. Do you have a severe insect problem on a specific crop? Search your state's official extension website to see if that pest overwinters in your area. If it does overwinter, where? Underground or above ground? Perhaps in the stalks of plants left standing. If it's underground, remove the leaf litter so the soil can freeze hard. If it's in the litter, triple shred and compost those leaves. If it's in the stems, remove them, triple shred them, and toss them in the compost. Note, you must clean up the leaf litter underneath disease and or insect-prone plants, especially trees, every season. If you choose to compost those leaves, the task must be done in a hot pile to prevent future problems. Conversely, you should research which butterflies, beneficials, and pollinators spend the winter in leaves in your region. Unless the leaves are on your lawn or a patio, walkway, or other potentially slippery surface, leave them be. Otherwise, just rake them off the lawn and walkways and into small piles. That won't hurt the bugs. Leaves put out for curbside pickup. If you want to make compost and use shredded leaves for mulch, but have a small area and don't want to risk harming overwintering sites, collect the leaves that other homeowners have foolishly put in brown bags and thrown away. Don't scavenge any bags that also contain grass clippings. If those clippings come from a treated lawn, the result will be plant-killing contaminated compost. And if you gather more than you need, make little piles of unshredded leaves around the garden to provide wintertime homes. And use the rest, shredded of course, for mulch and compost making. A final note, give special protection to fallen leaves near water sources. Frogs, toads, salamanders, and lightning bugs are especially likely to breed in these sites. Well, that sure was a lot of advice about the path to proper leaf procurement, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hide my leaf shredder if I don't get out of this studio. Woo, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3, or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Oh, and by the way, if you happen to live anywhere, please tell us where it is. And visit our Facebook page, where we post new photos of our gardens and yours every day. Share your observations and feedback. Provide important and informative updates about the show. A link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week. And links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he was fired from his third job at Marvel Comics, but it was only temporary. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Once again, special thanks to our very special guest, Elliot Coleman. His highly recommended new book, The Self-Fed Farm and Gardening, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method, is brand new from Chelsea Green Publishing. And because our interview went over our time limit, we're going to post the full interview with the podcast of this show. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and despite hard frosts all around me, I still have tomatoes growing outside, although all of my pepper plants have long been moved indoors under lights and warmth. And now, like the great Rogers Hornsby, I will sit by the window and dream of spring. But I'll get up long enough to come see you again next week.